The Sour Hour is meant for the serious brewer. The Sour Hour may contain some seriously funkified content. The Sour Hour is not for the faint of heart. So exercise some damn discretion, would you please? Sheesh. And now, here's the Sour Hour with Jay Goodwin.
Alright, it's that time. In the rainy traffic-filled Bay Area, we're here in downtown Concord. It's the Sour Hour on the Brewing Network. My name's Jay Goodwin. I'm from the Rare Barrel, an all-sour brewery in Berkeley. Here with Scott. How you doing, Scott?
Doing good, man. I didn't have to sit through that bull crap out on 680, man. Or no, 24?
Everything.
Everything was just a freaking bloody mess, huh?
Yeah, I should have taken Bart. And we're here with Bevo. How's it going, Bevo?
Bevo's talking to Kevin in there. You going to give us two thumbs up?
Hi, I have no idea what you're saying.
Oh, geez.
We just gave you tons of compliments. Yeah, she's not listening either. We have another guest in the studio tonight. It's Chris Johnson from Green Bend Brewing in St. Petersburg, Florida. How's it going, man?
Good. Green Bench.
Bench, sorry.
It's all good. No worries. Bad. No, that name gets mixed up a lot. We get Green Bench, Green Bend, other words.
Green Belt.
I haven't gotten Green Belt yet. Okay. I'm sure I'll get it.
Do the Rays, who are just two blocks away, do they wear green belts?
We need to get in on that, but no, they don't yet.
Okay, gotcha. Chris came by the Rare Barrel earlier and shared some of his awesome beers and his sour beers, and they're so good. I wanted to get him on the show for this first segment and talk a little bit about his kettle souring techniques. They just, you know, that's a technique I often find is just sometimes it's pretty hit or miss, and a lot of them are not very well done, but yours were awesome. So,
well, I appreciate that, man. It's been cool. So at Green Bench, at least for us, we love sour beers. It's my favorite style of beer, and something that I always wanted to sort of specialize in. What I found, though, is that we can only do so much with what we have, right? So based on climate control, stuff like that, we would have to really climate control an entire facility if we wanted to do, for example, beers like yours, which are phenomenal. And I was really excited to come by and try your beers. Been a fan of yours for a while. So
thank you.
Yeah. And so in order to do those kinds of beers, it would require some sort of control. We do have a climate controlled cellar room there where we do wine and spirit barrel aged sour beers. Only holds about 18 barrels. So everything that comes out of there is pretty limited and small batch. And we're able to play around with barrel aging sours. But it meant that I really had to get creative, I think, with how we soured beers. And there's a lot. I'm not by any means the first person, you know, or the only person making awesome kettle sour beers in the country. But I had to learn it pretty quickly and figure out how to make great ones in order to make sour beers that I loved. So
for sure. Well, they're tasting great. And we'll get into that in a little bit. Our guest tonight later on is Troy Casey of Casey Brewing and Blending. Scott, can you confirm or deny that we actually have some of his beers here tonight?
Confirm, baby.
Awesome.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even drink one drop to myself. Yeah, you know why? Because he sent three beers. Two look like the same Saison and then something else. And so I almost opened one of the Saisons, but then I was like, you know, this guy's a blender. I better make sure that these are the same beer. And they're not. Totally two different blends. So I did not crack it. It's all waiting for us.
Awesome. Well, can't wait to get into those and the different blends of his Saison and his the other stuff he's doing over at Casey Brewing and Blending in Colorado. Really cool stuff. But just for stuff that's going on at the Brewing Network, you guys I saw were just at Anchor Brewing. Is that right? Did you make that trip, Scott?
Yeah, sure did. Yeah, we did the session there on Monday, two nights ago. It's great, man. I mean, obviously, you've been to the Anchor Brewery, right?
One time, yeah.
Yeah. It's a phenomenal place. I mean, that is, if beer heaven exists, that's it. You know, multiple stories of copper kettles and expansive San Francisco views and just, you know, a legend around every corner. You know, you bump shoulders with your Mark Carpenters or your Bruce Josephs, and they were super hospitable, and I think it went really well.
It's a really interesting place, and we're lucky to have such a legendary brewery in our backyard.
No kidding.
The building is kind of funky. It looks like it's like a 1920s movie theater or something.
I don't know.
It's kind of
Art Deco for sure.
Yeah, you wouldn't think there's like, you know, one of the great craft breweries of all time in there, but there is.
And even their exterior branding is pretty subtle. You know, so it's like that nightclub that you know is cool because there's not even a sign that it indicates that it's a nightclub. But beyond that double door, oh, it's beer heaven.
Yeah, that's awesome. You guys definitely got to check out that session. One other Brewing Network thing I wanted to touch on is I was on the website today and I clicked over to the store and there's got to be some kind of mistake because I saw there's some Hop Grenade t-shirts for $8
yeah.
in the store.
No, that is a mistake. I told Justin 80. He must have misheard me.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I bought all of them. But if there's any left, you guys should check out the store. I think there are some items on sale up there. So definitely check it out. There's like a pretty nice Brewing Network scarf that I think is calling my name.
Would you? Oh, yeah. You'd rock a scarf?
I would. Yeah. It gets, you know, we keep our barrel warehouse at what we call cellar temperature.
It's golden there.
Yeah. The Hop Grenade staff came by the Rare Barrel yesterday to do some training, which really means drinking. And Scott was bundled up like he was catching a flight to Chicago or something.
Yeah, I did. I was rocking the mittens. And it's weird because anybody who knows me knows I generally run hot and I always want to be, you know, in the short sleeves. I'm always wearing the sandals in the 58 degree weather, which is really cold for California.
You're that guy.
Mm-hmm. I've been that guy my whole life. But I knew I was going to be drinking cold beer, and you're holding cold beer by the pint, as it were, at the Rare Barrel, because that's how they roll.
You guys, that's special.
Yeah. Not in general? Oh, okay. Well.
Sure. But it was a good time having you guys by, and that's when Chris came by yesterday as well, so that was a fun day. Quickly, I just wanted to recap our last show we had on Corey King from Side Project and Perennial. That was a really fun show, and we had some awesome beers that Corey sent our way. One thing, you guys should definitely check out that that episode. I think it's up on iTunes now. Really interesting how he splits up his duties. I mean, he's the head brewer at Perennial, but he's the owner and brewer at Side Project. And, you know, he made a comment that really stuck with me from last time, is just that Perennial, he's really worried about consistency. So he's trying to make the same barrel-aged beers over and over again. He's doing a great job. Some of his Imperial Stouts are in, like, the best beers in the world category rankings list, and the Side Project beers, the sours, are up there too. But he gets a little more adventurous with the sour beers, which is kind of fun. So it's like, you know, for his day job he's sticking to the rules, and then for his night job he's like, I'm gonna let it fly a little bit and see what happens.
He's like a superhero
for sure.
He gets off work at Perennial and just ducks into a phone booth and comes back out holding only a mash paddle, and it's off to the wild side.
Well, he's making some super beers. That's a joke.
Oh, the puns.
But yeah, I definitely recommend you guys going to check that. I wish we also had on Roberto from Hop Tech Homebrew. He brought by beers he made with Rare Barrel slurries that I had gave him. Actually, I forgot that I had given those to him. Give out a lot of those and never expect beer to come back. But slowly but surely, you know, we've been giving out a lot of yeast and bacteria samples to the local homebrewers, and in this case, homebrew shop owners. And it's just really cool to see people take those and run with them. His beers are really good. And, you know, it also goes to show that, you know, homebrewers they're totally capable of making exceptional sour beers. It's nice to give them a little bit of a head start with some more advanced cultures, a little more advanced Brett and bacteria. But, you know, Roberto, he's got all the knowledge. But, you know, for those of you listening maybe who aren't up to Roberto's level, that's what we try to do on this show. We're trying to advance not only your knowledge, but our knowledge. I'm lucky enough, I get to have these conversations with guys like Chris, guys like Troy all the time. And the idea behind the show is, hey, let's just put it on air, because I'm getting to learn all this stuff. You know, it's not like I'm an expert in this. I get the opportunity to talk to all these other great sour beer brewers. So let's share that on the Brewing Network air. And, you know, I definitely feel honored to have that responsibility.
Yeah. And for those of you who disagree with Jay's self-assessment and you do consider him to be a master, you can write in with questions for him at scott@thebrewingnetwork.com at any time throughout the week. You can join the chat for the show and you can call in.
888-401-BEER. So just getting quickly into a little bit of Rare Barrel stuff that's happened to us recently. We had a little bit of a good press bonus, I would say. It's just like we've had a really good year. It's been fun. We just had our first anniversary party. One of the the icing on the cake moments, though, was that we were just named one of the top 25 beers of 2014 by Draft Magazine, which is a huge honor.
Which beer?
It's Home Sour Home, actually. The beer that I forgot to bring that we were going to taste right now while I was talking about.
That's perfect.
You couldn't turn around in that traffic and go get it and come back and make it?
I could have just lied about it, too, and we could have just gone through the segment pretending like we were tasting it, but...
This sure is cinnamony.
I thought about it, yeah. But, yeah, no, I thought... I remembered that I forgot it about 1 hour and 58 minutes into my two-hour journey over, so... Needless to say, there were some expletives thrown out in the car.
Well, luckily, I had a chance to have some at the anniversary party on Saturday,
awesome.
At which I was also bundled up. I don't know if you saw, but I had the slick jacket on. It's the perfect November beer. And I was thinking how amazing it would be to pair it with just like some apple cobbler, you know, because it's got that cinnamon and that vanilla bean and something else, right?
Cinnamon, vanilla bean, and peach.
And peach.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just an amazing combination.
Yeah,
so
we'll,
good.
We'll definitely get you some for Thanksgiving. No worries about
please.
That. But, yeah, so I want to, you know, last time we talked about Cosmic Dust a little bit that had won an award recently. And, you know, as these beers kind of come up and I, you know, shamelessly self-promote them on the show, I kind of want to give out a little information about them in case, you know, people want to try out these recipes. So... Quick rundown on Home Sour Home for people who are interested in making that beer. If you listen back to, I believe it's the second episode, and you go off of our gold recipe that I gave out, brew that. It's a primary fermentation with Brett from Dre Fontanen and Lactobacillus delbrueckii. We get both of those from a lab called Brewing Science Institute. I don't think they do a lot to homebrewers, but... You know, if you look around hard enough, you can find either some substitutes or some other homebrewers who have those strains that you might be able to borrow them from. The gold recipe was a repitch of this mixed culture. So basically, we fermented a Berliner type of beer with that primary fermentation, and then we took the mixed culture off that and repitched it into the second batch. Ended up with a nice acidity to it. Is 3.33 pH final, if you want to compare to that when you try this at home. The peach aspect of it is 42 pounds per oak barrel, 8 ounces of cinnamon sticks per oak barrel, and 1 ounce of vanilla bean per oak barrel. This is a batch that it was a single batch, and we split it off into two. One half of it became our first blend, which is called Excuse Me, which is a golden sour with Brett and Lacto. And then we wanted to do a peach beer also and split that off. The base of the beer already had a strong peach character. So in order to differentiate it more from Excuse Me, we actually went ahead and added the spices to kind of make it into more of a peach cobbler kind of beer. So that was a fun one.
What, 1 ounce of vanilla bean per barrel, that sounds like very little. Is it? I'm picturing like a cup, you know, a stick.
It's like a couple of beans, basically.
That's
it's
not a lot.
It's more than flavor, because the flavor can get too intense with vanilla, in my opinion. It really changes the mouthfeel for me. It's like it makes it more of a smooth, I hesitate to say like gelatinous, but it reminds me of that like pie filling kind of like coating your mouth type of feeling.
Viscous.
Yeah, viscous. That's nice. So yeah, that's kind of why it was added. It comes out even in that little bit, but it's more added just to kind of make it seem more like a baked good and a sour beer at the same time.
What about you, Chris? You brew with vanilla bean?
I've brewed a lot of beers with vanilla bean. I've done a lot of stouts. We've done mostly just stouts. Some porters in the past. I've done nothing at the brewery, but yeah, mostly just stouts for vanilla bean. I've done stuff with actually, we did like a chocolate IPA once that I added vanilla bean too as a pilot batch. That was cool.
How'd that work out? Was that a good beer?
Yeah, I liked it. Didn't last very long. I couldn't like come back to it like the next week. So,
what you want to do a question, Jay? Before we, I would like to get to Troy.
Yeah,
we're,
for sure.
Already running overtime as per usual.
All right,
okay. So let's go.
Actually, you know what? Before we get to a question, what I really want to hit on this first segment is actually kettle souring. So Chris is in here because of. You know, I was really impressed with his beers. Maybe, Chris, you could just start off with, you know, kind of how you just, first off, what kind of lacto you have when you do your kettle sour, and then kind of go through what are you actually doing in the kettle, and how does a home brewer and a professional brewer kind of replicate what you're doing?
Yeah, it's not too hard. So we use the basic lacto D strain you can get from Y Yeast, White Labs. We get ours from BSI as well. I've used our specific lacto strain for almost 2 years now, between pilot batches as before the brewery opened, and then as we opened as well. So it's actually pretty simple. So what we do is we'll mash in as normal. We'll ladder to the kettle. We'll go to kettle full. Once we're at kettle full, instead of like turning our jackets on and boiling, what we'll do is we'll actually recirc the wort from the kettle through the heat exchanger back into the kettle until we get down to about 120 degrees. And we, by the time we're kettle full, we're usually about 160, 165 Fahrenheit. So we'll recirc, but using our oxygen stone, and this is probably the most important part, while using the oxygen stone, we'll hit it with CO2 instead of oxygen. So not only are we purging the tank of all of its oxygen, and instead of, as said, adding CO2, we're injecting CO2 into the liquid itself. So the entire, like, close to a half hour of recirc before it gets down, the entire kettle gets down to 120, we're just adding CO2. Once it's done, we're at 120, I'll cut off the heat exchange, basically just the boil kettle pump, cold liquor pump, keep the CO2 running, though, and then I take a culture of lactobacillus, which is actually just in a corny keg that I keep, and I'll hook it up with a ball lock black disconnect with a hose and tri-clamp fitting, hook it up to the back of the kettle, pump it with CO2 into the kettle, and I will set the jacket to 110 degrees. So essentially all you're trying to do is create the optimal fermentation environment for lactobacillus to quickly create lactic acid. But the key is clean lactic acid. A lot of sour beers that I've had that are kettle soured will have sort of off flavors. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, the one step that's the most important is making sure to purge everything with CO2. The most common thing that, or at least that I tell people is it's essentially a sensory test. So you'll come back within 12 hours, 24 hours, 48 hours, test it. I'll test off the back of the kettle. And again, I leave this crazy blanket of CO2 over the top of the kettle, even up through my exhaust and everything.
So that's after you're basically carbonating the wort. Yeah. So you're also topping it off with a blanket,
yeah,
or there's just that blanket there already?
I leave the CO2 on, mm-hmm, which is actually going to push all the liquid post heat exchange in through the kettle, into the kettle, okay, and then it's just pumping CO2. And I leave that going for like 5 minutes. So I let that thing just run.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so it's creating this blanket, CO2 being heavier than oxygen is going to purge everything out. Then once I pitch the lacto, I let it sit at 110 degrees on my jackets for, you know, about a couple days. In usually 24 hours to 48 hours, at 24 hours, I'll check every 12 hours. I'll just go around the back, take a sample off the back of the kettle, taste it. At that point, it's all sensory. You're trying to taste at what point is the acidity level appropriate for what you're trying to make?
Mm-hmm.
Once it's correct, then all I do is I just put a pH meter in there, test the pH. Now I know this is the actual pH I'm looking for this specific beer every time. Now,
and what is that usually?
Depends on the beer. Like Berliner Weiss, I usually go down about 3.2 to 3.4. We do a Surrealist IPA or Sour IPA like 3.6, 3.7. Our French Oak Oud Brune is like 3.1. So it depends on the beer. But once you find the acidity level you're looking for, and that's going to take time because obviously perceived acidity with, you know, sugar in solution is different than perceived acidity post-fermentation. But you'll sort of understand that as you do it a few times. Once you have that, I write down the pH. Then I'm just replicating the pH. I do the same step the next time. Now, when I come back to it, it's right at the pH I want. It's pretty easy. I hook the tri-clamp fitting right back up to the bottom of the kettle, fill the corny keg right back up. That's my starter for my next batch. So I just reuse that lacto. Then I boil it. At that point, if you're doing like a Berliner, you don't have to boil it longer than 15, 20 minutes. You're killing, mm-hmm, the lacto, throw in your little bit of noble hops to get 4 or 5 BUs, run that to your heat exchanger. At that point, you're hitting it with oxygen like you normally would. Goes into a stainless, Saccharomyces, it ferments out. 2 to 3 weeks, you have a Berliner Weiss that's pretty clean and nice. Now, the big key, I think, is making sure in sensory that you don't have off flavors. The most common off flavor that I've ever had when I taste people's sort of kettle sour beers, and I'm fortunate enough so far to not have had that happen since we opened the brewery, is you get this cheesy, almost like Parmesan cheese, kind of rancid kind of character.
Right.
And which a lot of people don't really know what to attribute that to. What I believe is happening is it's essentially a buildup of, well, a lot of people say, I've heard a lot of people say butyric acid. And it's not necessarily butyric acid because butyric is almost always vomit. Like it's like crazy bile. Usually what I think it always is isovaleric acid, which is commonly confused with butyric. Isovaleric, mm-hmm, is far more like the Parmesan cheese character.
Or like stinky feet.
Yeah, almost. Stinky feet. And actually, that's actually what happens with stinky feet. Literally, in like your toes, a bacterial strain will start eating. It'll start eating this thing called loose. Yeah, it's pretty disgusting. It smells like blue cheese, Parmesan. It's like a horrible, like, yeah, it's like a horrible roommate. It's horrible.
It smells like UCSB.
Yeah. There's actually this an essential amino acid called leucine. And leucine is what different bacterial strains will break down. Keep in mind, aerobic bacteria will break down and then create isovaleric acid. And that's the smell you get. Something that happens to have a lot of leucine, just naturally, things like corn, rice, wheat, barley. So everything that we use to make beer has this naturally in it. So usually what happens, I believe, is it's other bacteria, not necessarily the lactobacillus, in the presence of oxygen, creating this aerobic fermentation of this leucine and creating isovaleric acids, which smells like stink feet, like it's like funky feet. Now, the big key is major, just purge everything out. Luckily, when you're doing like kettle soured beers, you're not really, you can look for it, but you're not really going to find much sour, you know, off flavors that, for example, you're going to find. Like, you shouldn't have much acetobacter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, acetobacter, there's no ethanol, right? So acetobacter is oxygen, ethanol, you create acetic acid. That's what this bacteria does. And so then, therefore, you shouldn't have any of the off flavors that acetobacter and creation of acetic acid would lend. For example, ethyl acetate, you know, nail polish kind of characteristic. You shouldn't have any of that because there's no actual, there's no yeast, so there's no ethanol, there's no alcohol, there's also no oxygen. The best way to get rid of all of these is just to make sure you have a true anaerobic environment. If you don't have that true anaerobic environment, you will get the horrible feet smell and all that stuff. So it's really pretty simple. I think as long as you can put a lot of CO2 in there, you should be fine.
That's awesome. And, you know, that's great advice for people who love sour beer. They want to get into it, but maybe they don't want to embark on that, you know, Brett, bacteria, fermentation, barrel aging side. I mean, your beers are awesome. We got to try a few of them yesterday, and that's one of the best Berliners I've ever had, for sure.
Oh, thank you.
So people listening right now, you know, how can they get your beer? What's going on at Green Bench in the next couple of months? What's
right on. Back home is basically where you can only get our beers right now. But it's pretty exciting. We started to release a few sour beers in bottles. So we had our first bottle release about a month ago. We released two beers. Our first is a Web City cellar beer, which is our climate-controlled cellar room for wine and spirit barrel-aged sour beers. It's a rye sour brown fermented with Brettanomyces clesinii in Cabernet Sauvignon barrel wood aged for 9 months. And then we did our Wood Parade series, which is our spirit barrel-aged series, which happens to be an apple brandy barrel-aged tart cherry imperial stout. It's brewed with over a pound of cherries per gallon of beer, actually slightly acidified with lactobacillus as well, because I was afraid I wasn't going to get the tart character from the cherries. So I acidified it slightly to mimic the tart character. But that's not to say that someone that's doing kettle-soured beers can't do barrel-aged beers as well. I mean, our sour brown is kettle-soured, run into Cabernet Sauvignon barrels and fermented with wild yeast to be this true American wild ale. And even further, this allows us to breach or to walk upon a path that we haven't been able to with sour beers. For example, we specialize in a lot of hoppy sour beers. So we do our Surrealist IPA, which is a sour IPA, or Colliding Galaxy Sour Double IPA, all these sort of sour hoppy beers that you weren't able to do because hops prohibit the growth of bacteria and the production of sour flavors. So with this technique, you can get your sour, then you can add hops in your boil normally and make it an IPA. So there's a whole like road of sour beers we've never gotten to make before. And there are breweries that do it. I mean, Trinity Brewing makes awesome sour IPAs. I know the Commons, actually almost all their sour beers are kettle soured as well. So we're definitely not the only ones that do kettle sour well, but they're awesome. So awesome. Yeah. And so we got more bottle releases coming out. Probably in March, we'll do another cellar beer, and every 4 months we release a brand new sour beer from our cellar room.
Awesome. It's great info. Thanks so much, Chris, for joining us. It's Chris Johnson from Green Bench Brewing in St. Petersburg. If you're anywhere near there, make the drive, get over there, get those beers. I think Scott's giving me some looks because we're going a little bit over on the segment. So.
I want to drink Troy's beer, man.
I know. Yeah, you don't have a beer. So let's take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is the Sour 2 Hours on the Brewing Network.
Starting a brewery is not for the faint of heart. It's definitely a labor of love.
If you're not going to give it 100%, don't bother. Brewers Publications is proud to present the Brewers Association Guide to Starting Your Own Brewery by Elysian Brewing's Dick Cantwell. Business plans, financing, sustainability, and more. This book takes you through the planning and execution needed to turn the dream of craft brewing into a reality. Whether you want to open a brew pub or a packaging brewery, learn the professional side of ingredients, wastewater, quality, and how to build the craft brewery of the future. The Brewers Association Guide to Starting Your Own Brewery, available now from Brewers Publications and BrewersPublications.com.
Bring a bomb to the battlefield, buddy. Black beast, bringing bottoms that boom. letter C.
Crazy character, constantly creating concoctions. Catalyst of cannibalistic rhymes, conqueror, correctly connecting craniums, crumble down, consistent capacity.
Next, we'll hear words that start with the letter D.
Done did that, done did this, diddle don. Domination, don't dignify diction. Doing it deep down, dialect during doomsday. Duck devastate during the duration.
Listen to our song for all ages.
Extraterrestrial, electrical, effortless, eons of energy, everyone affected, efficiently, epitomize, excellent, extravagant, elevate where the essence is.
F is the letter with which these words
like Alicia's got funk for the future, filling up things finally, fabulous, furious, fatness, follow me, makers fall frequently, fact, verbal felon fired up, federally foundation, fake all of this whack shit.
Carefully again, words with sounds for letter G.
All right, we're back on the Sour Hour. Still hanging with Chris from Green Bench and
Nailed
Scott
it.
And Bevo. We're doing well. We're going to talk to Troy Casey in a minute, but Scott told me he has something really important to say first.
Indeed, I do. First off, I can't wait to drink these Saisons from Troy. And if you want to be like Troy or like Jay and you want to start your own brewery, the Brewers Association's Guide to Starting Your Own Brewery will help you plan and open a thriving, quality-oriented brewery. This is something that you wish existed before when you were getting started, Jay. I'll tell you what. Industry veteran Dick Cantwell, you guys know Dick from Elysian?
Great brewer.
Yeah, he adeptly covers ingredients, financing, business plans, quality assurance, distribution, wastewater, sustainability practices, and more. You know, for you, a prospective brew pub and packaging brewery owners. Cantwell walks the reader through the planning and execution required to turn craft beer dreams into reality. I know many of you have those dreams, so this is the place to turn to make it happen.
You know, it was around when I was starting a brewery, but it was like the first version. It wasn't the one that's currently out. And yeah, I wore that thing out cover to cover. I mean, I took extensive notes on all that. That's a tremendous book. If you're starting a brewery without that, you're just making a huge mistake.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
throwing away money, and it's like, I don't know how much it costs, but it should be $10,000. So if you're starting a brewery, you got to get that amongst, you know, a lot of the Brewers Association publications. It's all must read, because if you're not willing to read a book to start a brewery, you know, you're not going to be willing to do all the other stuff it takes.
Right. Maybe you should just go dream about starting a t-shirt company like every loser I knew back in Santa Barbara. Oh, they had a great idea, and they're going to do a t-shirt company.
I have an idea for a t-shirt company. We got to talk about it off air, though, because it's, you know, proprietary.
Give your ideas away. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but enough jibber jabber. Let's get to our guest tonight, Troy Casey from Casey Brewing and Blending. Are you there, Troy?
How's it going, boys?
Good to hear your voice, man. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been good. Missed you guys in Denver. Was it last month? But well done on that award. That's awesome.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, before we give you your full intro, maybe you could actually tell us a little bit about the beers we're drinking. We have Saison Blend 2 and Saison Blend 3 in front of us.
We do.
What's your big takeaway from the difference between the two?
So those all came from the some of the original batches I did back in April. We started brewing those in April. So the difference between Blend 2 and Blend 3 is really just age and then the barrels they came from. So Blend 2 spent about 2 months in oak, and Blend 3 spent about 3 months in oak before they were packaged. And so what I wanted to show you guys tonight was just kind of how the blending process can make similar beers, but also pretty different as well. And so to me, Blend 3 is a little bit thicker. It's got a little bit more viscosity. When I first poured it, you could just hear it was different when you were pouring it because of the thickness of it. And I was like, uh-oh, diacetyl, right? And it has to be diacetyl. What else would make viscosity like that? But I never picked up any butter in it. Hopefully you guys don't either. But it just kind of goes to show you how different, how simple blending can be from when you speak about it, but how complex the flavors can come from it.
Yeah, definitely. No, these are clean, free of off flavors. And
yeah, not a hint of butter.
Yeah, I'm really digging them. And I can, you know, there's some off flavors I don't get at all, but butter is one I feel like I can pick out from Milo, and there's nothing that. These are tasting real good, Troy. So a little background on Troy. Let's see. I don't know where to start, but is it true that you started as a tour guide at Coors and then it kind of came full circle a few years later?
Absolutely. Yeah. About 10 years ago, I started as a tour guide at Coors. I was doing my undergrad in chemistry at the time. Had zero interest in going into any of the traditional chemistry major career pathways. And then when I was a tour guide, I realized that I could have a career in brewing. And so that's kind of where I focused my attention and turned my attention. I started working at Bristol Brewing Company in Colorado Springs at the time with Jason Yester, who now is the brewer at and owner at Trinity. And then I had a couple internships at Coors before I went closer to you guys to UC Davis, and I did my master's there in food science. I worked for the AB Brewery there in Fairfield while I was there. Left Davis 2008, and then got a job working in the pilot brewery at Coors.
Awesome. And Troy, maybe just to take another step back, you know, we're drinking your beers right now, but for all the people who don't have them in front of them, can you explain the way that you ferment your beers? And, you know, you say that you make these in an old world style. What does that mean to you?
So just about a year ago to the day, I left my job at Miller Coors, and I started out on the pathway to where we are today. So I'm the owner of Casey Brewing and Blending. We're in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. It's about 2.5 hours west of Denver. We're in Glenwood Springs, which is kind of a tourist town, about 40 minutes outside of Aspen. And this is kind of where my wife and I decided this is where we wanted to make a go at it and make our brewery. And so, yeah, we're making old world Belgian style beers. The first of them are the Saisons, which you're trying right now. We ferment 100% and age 100% in oak wine barrels using mixed culture, having a mixed culture fermentation. And so everything is fermented in oak. So these Saisons are actually fermented in puncheons, which I converted into open fermenters. And so I took a 500-liter puncheon, took the heads off of on one side, put some valving on it, and now we've got an open fermenter. So that's where we add three different types of saison yeast. So it's about 90% DuPont, 10% French saison yeast. We'll add some Brett, the Dre Fontaine from Brett, like BSI, as you guys were talking about. Some lacto also from BSI, and then some other cultures. And then we'll let them ferment in those barrels for about 6 or 7 days, after which we'll rack over to smaller, more traditional wine barrels for anywhere from 6 weeks to 3 or 4 months for the Saison, for that series of beers.
Awesome, man. You're getting a real high level of complexity and a nice soft acidity in that relatively short amount of time. These beers are absolutely beautiful. What are some of the things you consider when you try to do an uncontrolled open fermentation? And, you know, I saw on your Facebook, you're, at least, you know, positing what's going to happen with your colder weather now and how that's going to affect the fermentations. Can you touch on kind of like the amount of control you have on your fermentations and how you think that'll play out?
Absolutely. And so again, I mean, old world goes past just the fermentation. We don't have any temperature control. We've got a heater in our warehouse here, but in our cellar area, but that's it. But we don't have any temperature control in those food punch-in fermenters. We're not filtered. We're bottle conditioning. So we're kind of I try to envision like how would brewers have done it pre-industrial era. And so we don't have a forklift. We don't have a lot of things that most traditional brewers have now. So for us, yeah, seasonality is going to play into it. When it's warmer, our barrel room gets into the mid to high 70s. And so when it's colder, like right now here, it gets into the low single digits at night. So our cellar is around in the 50s at night, and that's going to have an effect on that open fermentation, which we don't have any control from temperature wise. And so I'm okay with that just because it's fun to tell the consumers. And my consumers are passionate about those differences because they understand this isn't something that is reproducible. My goal is to always, whenever you try that Saison from now until for the next however long I get to brew that for, an average consumer wouldn't be able to tell the differences, but the people that are passionate, like ourselves, can kind of geek out about the intricacies of the different batches. And so it'll come through the blending process where we'll really get to make the same type of flavors and try to make something that's a little bit reproducible, but always knowing that it'll never be the exact same. So we help during the winter, what I'm trying to do is maybe cool the wort a little bit warmer. So like in the low 70s, whereas in the summer, it might be in the high 60s, so that they can get a kickstart, the yeast can get a kickstart. I'm not really worried about any infection from a fermentation since we're using open fermenters, just because we're giving it a good strong culture to start. And I think anything that might contribute off flavors will be outcompeted during the fermentation. And so yesterday we just did the seventh brew of the Saison and we've been open for about 7 months now. And so we're very, very tiny. We just sell about 100 cases a month right now.
Mike is in the chat room and he asks you guys, do you think the isovaleric acid smell goes away, or changes with aging?
Oh, that's a good question. It's Chris here from Green Bench. I don't think it does. I think that if you ever are kettle souring and get to a point and you taste that, I would dump that right now. Just the entire kettle. I mean, the big key is that why risk it, really, is how I look at it. At this point, all you've really spent money on is a bacterial strain that you can easily grow up again, grain. You haven't risked any of your cellar equipment. You haven't risked a barrel. You haven't risked anything, your packaging stuff. So it's a lot easier, I think, at this point, just to dump it down the drain and then start over with your mash. Real quick, though, since I have the mic, Troy, I actually have a question for you. I know you. So you're doing open fermentation, and your concept is obviously each batch to be quite different than the last. At Green Bench, I actually have a fooder, and in it we do our farmhouse sales, and the concept is 100% oak fermented farmhouse sales. Do you clean your punch and barrel in between batches? I heard you say that you add a culture, because the way that I do it is we actually decided that we wouldn't clean it in between batches because we wanted to use the inoculate as its biggest defense against anything wild, while understanding that eventually it will take its own turn into whatever it needs to be one day. So it is definitely the same kind of concept, hands off, allowing the nature to kind of control and mimic and change and adapt, with us not really having much control over it. That's how we did it. I'm just curious if you clean it in between batches.
Yeah, so the punch tins are 500 liters. And so after 6 or 7 days, the majority of, or at least a lot of the yeast settles out to the bottom of the barrel. And so we rack off of that. And then what we're left with is a slurry at the bottom. What I'll usually do is just harvest around either up to a growler full of yeast from that what has settled out. And then I totally clean it. And so, and that just means hot water and elbow grease.
Of course.
And I like that because putting wort onto yeast cultures, the cultures just keep growing and growing in mass. And then like something for me that I lose sleep over is foam stability and having a good foam on a beer. And when you have autolysis of different flavors, that is something that is a concern to me. I clean them and then repitch what I harvested for the next batches.
Right on. What we do is when we finish our fermentation, we pull everything out and we actually dump almost all the yeast out to try to avoid as much autolysis as possible until we have sort of the slurry, the amount that we want. And then we'll just essentially, like the wort inoculate kind of concept, at that point, fill it right back up on what's left and allow it to do its thing.
Sounds pretty similar. Yeah.
Hey Troy, speaking of your process a little bit, tell us a little bit about your focus on specifically Colorado ingredients and local fruit. You know, how do you pick the types you're going to use? How do you source them? How do you process them? All those types of details.
So again, going back to that old world farmhouse brewing tradition where brewers would make beer with what they grew on their own fields or on their neighbor's farms. I'm making those beers that you're trying today. Those are made with 100% Colorado ingredients. Old world, this is what people would make beer with. And Colorado is one of the few states that we've got that you can grow everything that you need to make these types of beers. And so I definitely can't make beers with the fancy designer hops, but I can make some fun farmhouse beers with what we've got. So we use both malted and raw barley and wheat. We use Colorado-grown Crystal and Cascade hops. The yeast comes from Brewing Science Institute, which it sounds like a lot of people are familiar with, and then obviously local water. To me, it's what I want to do. I like to say that I spend more time talking with farmers and growers than I do doing finance. And I do my own finance. And so, but that's just why, like, one of the things that got me into brewing was being able to talk to people that are just as passionate, as we are, being brewers. They're just as passionate about what they get to make. And so I get to talk with the growers. I know the families that make my ingredients. And I think that's, it gets a lot, you know, nowadays brewers can pick up the phone and order everything they need from around the world from talking to one person. And that's a great thing. That's what got us to this point today for in the American craft brew industry. But again, that's what a lot of people are doing. And so I wanted to kind of differentiate myself in that sense a little bit. And being here on the western slope of Colorado, where a lot of that agriculture comes from, it was kind of a no-brainer. Being able to talk to growers, you realize what they love. I go out to the fields and I talk with growers and say, like, what's your favorite plum variety? And they're like, oh, you got to try the elephant heart plums. Like, and then he just goes and picks one off the tree. And we're tasting it. I'm like, oh, my God, this is so good. Why is nobody doing this? And it's just because it's kind of like something that nobody's really gotten to yet. And so that's kind of where I'm going. That's what I'm passionate about is talking to people and learning what's good. Again, it comes down to that old world pre-industrial era. Brewing techniques, which was you made beer with what you had, and that's what I do. I'm gonna make beer with what I've got.
Awesome. Any more questions from the chat for the group, Scott?
Yeah. Well, there's a bunch on email, so let's get to those.
Yep.
Here's one from Richard Daudry. He said, "Greetings, guys. If I have a barrel that has sat empty and has started growing mold inside, what are my options?"
Well, from my perspective, I mean, easiest thing to do is just get rid of it. I mean, that's the safe way to know that, you know, you're never going to introduce mold to your beer. You know, if you want to try to save it and put a batch of beer in there and you're intent on doing that, we use a few chemicals. So we use, I'd start with hot water and sodium percarbonate, rinse that all out pretty well with additional hot water, and then do a rinse with citric acid after that. And then I'd leave it in a solution of potassium made of bisulfite and citric acid for quite a while. That's what we use as our, those last two are what we use as our storage solution when we're not using barrels for a long time. But I mean, you are risking it. I mean, there are things, molds and yeast, they can grow deep into the wood more than you can just see on the surface. I think I heard a story from an interview that was actually on Brewing Network, from Matt Brindleson, and he said that he found Brettanomyces in their barrel program, but like deep, centimeters deep into the oak. And they're obviously only putting clean beer in there, and they've got, you know, probably the most expensive barrel steamer on the market, and they're crazy about testing, and they have super smart brewers and all this stuff.
And
so,
even still.
Yeah, if they find Brett deep in the wood, then, you know, what's to stop mold from growing deep in the wood? So That would be my hesitation, but if you want to give it a shot, that's my recommendation. Chris or Troy, do you have any more additional tips on that?
I personally would toss the barrel. We back home in where I am in St. Petersburg, it's really tropical, so we actually have a mold issue, especially like in our cellar, and it basically has come down to getting a dehumidifier and literally weekly pulling all of our barrels out, cleaning the entire room. Using a little bit of quaternionia, which is what we'll end up using to kill any mold, even down to like very small amounts with water and slightly brushing the barrels a little bit, because just to avoid it getting seeping into the barrels. But if I ever found something on the inside, I think I'd just get rid of it.
Cool. And Troy, anything to add to that?
Absolutely. And so assuming that they're going to make a sour beer or a wild beer with that barrel, I think. Again, I'm going to go fall back on that old world idea, which is what would a farmer do if they found that back 200 years ago? They're going to use that barrel because that's the only one they've got. So, yeah, if you can treat it with a little steam, a little hot water, especially a little elbow grease, I mean, that's an aerobic culture, whatever that is. And so you scrub that away, give it some hot water, give it a good culture in there. I think it's worth the risk. If it's not easy like it is for all of us to get an extra barrel, I would try it.
Yeah, look at you, Chris and Jay. You spoiled first worlders, you. Oh, just get
well,
rid of it.
Troy is just a great marketer. He's staying on brand so well.
That was what every homebrewer wanted one of us to say. So
yeah, you're a hero now, Troy. But Scott,
fermentation in the barrel, and then you're going to be even a little bit safer if you actually ferment in the barrel. It'll just add complexity.
It's just going to be an overwhelming inoculation. So yeah. Do we have time for another question, Scott?
Yeah, let's tease it over the break. It's a little bit more of a complex question.
Ooh,
I'll let the three of you guys marinate on it during the break. So this one is all the way from Sweden, from Bjorn Lundsten. He says, greetings. Currently greetings. Operating a small micro 5-hectoliter system. Had an idea of creating a micro sour program with a single Solera, which would be a 30 to 50 hectoliter dairy tank that would be filled with wort pre-fermented with an ale strain and then set to sour with some bacteria in the larger vessel, a stainless vessel, in some kind of temperature-controlled environment. The idea would be that you could, with certain intervals, pull off 500 liter and add 500 liter fresh, and hence creating a larger variant of the one-vessel Solera's homebrewers use. Do you guys see any obvious downsides to this approach? And then what temperatures and sour strains would you propose for the tank, given that one perhaps would like to pull something like this twice per year, he says. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's a meaty question. I think we've all got our opinions on it, but you'll hear them after the break. This is the Sour Hour on the Brewing Network.
Since the first time the Brewing Network microphones turned on, More Beer was behind it. More Beer sponsors the programming on the BN because, like you, they love brewing. And like the Brewing Network, they love sharing their knowledge. Morebeer.com isn't just a website to place your next equipment or ingredient order. Morebeer.com also gives you access to free beer information that will make you a better brewer. Go to morebeer.com and click into the Learning Center. You'll find podcasts, technical facts, video tutorials, and more, including access to The Buzz, More Beer's social network of more than 5,000 members. And some of them might even be crazier about beer than you are. Get over to morebeer.com today and take advantage of The Buzz, the forum, the Learning Center, and make sure you're signed up to receive the newest More Beer catalog. More Beer, bringing you absolutely everything for beer making.
This is what it is. It's the urban organic Mike mechanic. Superhuman MC powers help me fly around the planet. Touch the microphone device, whole countries get frantic. Saving damsels in distress so young girls don't panic. Put MCs under pressure till they crack like ceramic. Always thought they could flow, but sank like the Titanic. Rhymes rip through your skull like icebergs through the hull. Survive the impact and Arctic cold freezes your soul. Create a new style, then break the mold. Positions are controlled and liable to explode like landmines. My crew blow through like wind chimes. Make it hot like fire, 200 proof like moonshine. Whiskey, playing yourself is risky. And the flow's mad jazzy like Dizzy Gillespie. And the sound be harmonious and deadly like a harpy. Call me the great one like Wayne Gretzky. No man can test me, so I try. Focus like a samurai, stronger than a mata. Or a tsunami, I mean tsunami. I rock it from MTV to the BBC. Radioactive waves short out your TV. Aliens be checking for me in the next galaxy. Put it in a time capsule till the next century. In a blackout, use it for electricity. Danger, high voltage. Dope fiends need their daily dosage. I break it down mathematically. 99.9 is the percentage. Like closing fine wine, the rhymes are vintage. And the universal will give me strength like spinach. With vintage, I eat it like a tofu sandwich. With cabbage, ask your girl, she knows that I'm not the average nigga who claims to pull the trigger. Reality's the root of the rhymes that I configure. Phony, baloney, swear they're Don Corleone. But when shit hit the fan, they start crying like Pretty Tony. Tender like Roni.
young that smash to rockin' rhymes is my hobby. You're probably like, what's he on? Cause I rock it from the start till the beat is gone. Not in the mafia, but I'm the microphone don. And the words that I shoot out my mouth for Teflon. Jeru, never touch ya, microphone wrecker. Need out in the stretcher, step up in my sector. Try to match wits, but the mental will crush ya. Jeru, the damager, the sun toucher. Peace.
What song is that, Scott? That is awesome.
This is Cut Off by Kasabian from the same album as our intro.
Really? Yeah. This is Kasabian still? Wow, yeah. I gotta check that out. Yeah, you can do it.
Let it ride.
All right.
Hey, guys, so if you like this show, you will definitely like other shows on the Brewing Network, like Dr. Homebrew. That airs tomorrow night, mostly Thursdays, sporadically in any given month. That is hosted by our one and only JP, John Palmer, JP.
Oh, okay.
This is Mr. Petros' show, where it's basically an on-air beer judging session. Like, if you want to hear how a BJCP judge is going to judge your beer in competition, but you want to hear what their thought process is like, and you want to hear it in real time, Dr. Homebrew's the show. And then, of course, there's Brew Strong that is airing this Friday. So we got a Sour Hour, Dr. Homebrew, and Brew Strong back to back to back.
Wow. What are they going to talk about on Brew Strong? Do you know?
Q&A. Just beer wisdom from John Palmer and Jamil Zainashev to a wide range of brewing questions.
Love awesome. Both those shows.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome.
Oh, yeah? You learn a little bit from them?
I did. Actually, yeah. I for a long time, I was a homebrewer and actually worked in a homebrew shop and taught brewing classes. And I listen to Dr. Homebrew a lot. Actually, I'm a nationally certified BJCP judge now, but it was had to there do a go. Lot with that, man.
Good man.
It helped.
I've been on a boring family vacation before and just gone through like the old Jamil show and like some Brew Strongs and just like, wow, I should really be like taking in some culture right now, but I'm really just listening to Brewing Network all day.
Right.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
What are you saying? Are you saying we're not cultured?
We've got Troy Casey on the show tonight. He's the founder and blender at Casey Brewing and Blending in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. He is the man. He's serving us some great beers here. We've got actually the cherry fruit stand in front of us now. Can you tell us a little bit about this, Troy?
I think maybe before he does, he wants to make a quick follow. He messaged me frantically during the break. I got to make a follow-up to the last question, so go for it, baby.
Awesome. I just wanted to say if the barrel smells bad, there's no hope. It's just dump it, take the loss. But if it's just a little growth and it smells fine, I stand by my previous assessment.
Awesome.
There you go.
Can you give us a quick hit on this cherry fruit stand? Then we'll answer that question we talked about before the break.
Absolutely. So the fruit stand series is taking the saison and aging it on fresh whole fruits. And so the version you guys are drinking is with cherries, and I believe it's with the Montmorency cherry, which is the traditional pie cherry. The cherries at about a pound per gallon. I drive out to Hotchkiss, Colorado, and go get my grower, and they're picking the cherries while we're watching. Take those cherries, get them back on beer in the same day. And so again, about a pound per gallon. We take the whole cherries, just give them a quick wash with water just to get any dirt or leaves off of them, and then they go right into an oak barrel. We'll rack a chosen blend of saison onto the cherries, let them ferment for another anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks, and then we'll rack them off the fruit, get them into our blending tank, add yeast and sugar, and then they'll undergo bottling for about another month or so. So that's we've done three different cherry varieties of that fruit stand, and this is one of my favorites.
Troy, I love the terroir nature you have in these beers. I have a quick question. Do you break the cherries up at all before you put them in, or are they going in whole?
So this we've done two sour cherries and one sweet cherry version. Sour cherries are very delicate, right? I'm sure you guys all know this, but sour cherries, when they're picked off the tree, the stem stays behind, and so the flesh is exposed instantly, which is why you kind of never see a sour cherry on the shelf. They're always frozen. They've got a really like short shelf life. And so really just the processing of the sour cherry, getting them into a barrel, breaks them up pretty good. The sweet cherries, though, we have to, which made some really unique flavors that I was really excited about. We have to de-stem those and then basically hand crush them because we have to expose the flesh. And so with the sour cherry, just minimal processing gets everything in contact with the beer, in my opinion.
Awesome. I actually didn't know that about sour cherries. That's pretty cool.
I didn't either. I didn't want to admit, but you started it. So yeah, I didn't know either.
I mean, you got so much experience with whole fruit, Troy. That's, part of the reason you're on the show besides your awesome beer. This is tasting great, by the way. I don't want to forget, we did tease a question from Bjorn from Sweden. Yes. Before the break. And, you know, I'm not going to make you repeat the whole thing, Scott, but it sounded to us, we were discussing a little bit during the break, like sort of a smaller version of basically what New Belgium does. Do you have a take on that, Troy?
I've never done anything with Solera's. The only point I want to make is when you do a Solera method or you only have one tank that you're trying to create something wild or sour from, is that you just run the risk of it not turning out well. So for me, the blending aspect of KC Brewing and blending is that we have different options, and we can make unique flavors from other things, and we don't basically put all our eggs in one basket, which is what you're doing and what this gentleman sounds like he's doing. And so you can have great success with it, but when you, like you just mentioned, New Belgium, they've got a whole, it's like an airplane hangar full of booters that they can blend from as well. And so that's the only risk that I see, but I'm sure you guys know more about this than I do.
I mean, no, that's a terrific answer. And I agree, you know, it is putting all your eggs in one basket. You know, just before you do that, just make sure your culture is strong enough, I think would be my advice. Like, why put it in this, no matter how big or small the tank is, why put it, you know, prove to yourself that you can make 1 gallon of great sour beer. Prove to yourself you can make 5 gallons of great sour beer before you're trying to make 50 gallons. I'm terrible at converting from hectoliters, so I have no idea. And it was like 10 minutes ago, so I don't remember the exact volume. But that would be my advice.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't use the Solera as a, like, whatever you're taking off, probably as what you package. I mean, as Casey has already kind of said and what Jay's kind of mentioned, I would probably use that as the blend. Like, you take that off, and I would use it to blend back with maybe a farmhouse ale that you've made or something else that you made to sort of make these really complex flavors. That's how New Belgium does it. They'll take some off. They'll, you know, blend it with different beers, make this awesome beer, and then they fill it back up with a already fermented beer, and that's your inoculate.
Yeah, for sure. And that definitely gives you a little bit of wiggle room. Troy, I was wondering, you know, we've got our Saison varieties in front of us, but you've also got another beer in the pipeline. Can you tell us a little bit about the difference between these beers and your Belgian-style sour that might be out maybe end of the year or beginning of next year?
Absolutely. And so we're trying to do Belgian-style sour beers. And so the Saison, those farmhouse beers that you guys are trying now, it's just one part of it. The other part is kind of lambic-inspired beers, lambic-styled beers. We're not doing spontaneous, so I would never even begin to call it lambic. But it's those are some of my favorite beers to drink. And so something that I did back when I worked at Coors was basically think, what if you pitched the cultures that you have available to you into a wort, like a lambic style wort, what would happen? So we tried that. It worked out pretty well. We called that colorambic at the time. And that's the actual beer that really gave me the itch to start my own brewery. Before that, I thought I'd just be working at MillerCoors for my whole life, and that didn't work out. But here we are. So we took like a lambic style wort, so 60-65% pale malt, 35% raw wheat, a bunch of aged hops, go through the traditional brewing process, cool it down, add the wort to oak barrel. So we've got both Punchins and like Bordeaux barrels, so 228 liters, 500 liter barrels. And then we add all the cultures that we think that I thought and I had available to me that might be in Lambic. And so back when I was working at Coors, those were we had some pretty good results. And so I've taken it a little bit further on this project. So those are about 4 to 6 months old right now in my cellar. Not quite there yet. I was hoping they would be, but they obviously can't rush a good sour beer. So we're just going to sit on those. Maybe I'll probably taste some of those barrels here in a couple weeks. But I'm in no hurry really for those. And so that's really the other half of what we're trying to do at Casey Brewing and Blending is make something that is reminiscent of what probably all of our favorite beers are.
Scott, we have a caller on the line.
Yeah. Hey, Alex.
Hey, how are you doing?
Hey, good. You in Ontario, California, or Ontario, Canada?
Canada.
Oh, nice.
Kitchener, Ontario.
A long way away up in Canada. What's up?
Yeah, so I'm a brewer up here at a little 10-barrel brewery, and we're starting to do some sour stuff now. So I just had a couple questions about some of the processes that we're looking at doing.
For sure.
So right now we have about 14 barrels filled with non-sour beers. But then as they're getting empty, we're wanting to fill them with sour beers. So they're kind of emptying one or two at a time, not enough to brew a full 10-barrel batch into. So one thing that we've been talking about doing was brewing like a small batch of a wort that would finish out at a high gravity and then blending that in with like our standard Saison, which is a beer that we have all the time, into a barrel. To have some more, like a higher finishing gravity, to give the bacteria and yeast more to eat, I guess. I don't know if that is something that you would recommend. I don't know what kind of, when you guys go into barrels, how high of gravity do you generally go in with, I guess, is one of my questions.
All right, well, yeah, starting there. So let me ask one clarifying question first before we dive in. So you're talking about brewing a high gravity wort. And then blending with the Saison. So is that blending a wort with a finished beer and then going into barrel?
Sorry, yeah, so that wasn't very clear. I was talking about brewing like a wort that would finish fermentation higher.
Oh, okay.
So mashing higher and maybe a lot of oats or wheat or something like that. Because we don't have much of that in our Saison, like our regular Saison recipe. Mm-hmm. And then blending that with our Saison in the barrels.
Well, one suggestion that I would give right off the bat, Alex, is that, you know, it seems like you've kind of got these just couple barrels open at a time. So, you know, maybe you're trying to hold off from brewing a full batch. What I would do is maybe you say you have the Saison, run off a little bit of it as you're going to the fermenter, and then just do 100% barrel fermentation with, you know, a little bit of your Saison batch. You know, you'll be short on that for one batch. But then you're filling those two barrels at a time. And so you'd be going in at whatever your Saison's original gravity is, and you'd be doing a primary sour beer fermentation. It's something that Troy's doing all the time. It's something that I'm doing all the time. You can definitely have really good success with that. But, you know, you could also do the classic way of fermenting it out and then putting in the barrels afterwards.
Right.
In that case, I would suggest that you really grow up your sour culture nice and strong beforehand, because everyone who tries that kind of classic method, they often have problems producing a lot of good, high-quality lactic acid over time.
Yeah.
If they leave, and then what they do is they leave it in the barrel until it sours. And what they're doing is they're introducing oxygen and acetic acids being produced, and then ethyl acetate in an extreme example.
Yeah.
So what I would do is just make sure you have a very strong culture because it's going to be going up against alcohol in that secondary fermentation. But Chris, what do you think?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's something else that I would suggest. If you're interested in sort of using these barrels for now and then using them again later to actually use bacteria, something that I've had a lot of success with is taking a Saison that I on purpose will ferment a little bit lower to create a lot of phenolic characters. You can put in the barrel and you can pitch either several strains or one specific strain, make sure it's a good culture of Brettanomyces. So what you can do is you can make a really good Brett barrel-aged beer, Saison. I would suggest making a quite highly phenolic sort of Saison character. Your Brett's going to be pretty active pretty quickly, tearing down those phenolics and make some really cool Brett characters. And then by the time that's done, you can essentially just let it sit in the barrel with Brett, Make sure it's topped off. Feel pretty comfortable that the Brett's going to keep as much oxygen out as possible until you're open with a bunch of barrels. Then you take those off, and then I would suggest making a sour burn of those barrels. But that's obviously just a different option that you'd have.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Interesting.
Troy, anything to add to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I agree 100% with you, Jay. The only thing I'm going to add is that when you think about putting in a low attenuated beer into a barrel, I mean, it makes sense on paper, like you're giving the Brett and things like that something to work with, but it's never worked out for me. I think you're going to end up with problems when it comes time to bottle the beer, because if you're going to be bottle conditioning or even if you force carbonate, you're going to probably have more attenuation occurring later on in the process. And so for me, I would say just do something standard. Use a yeast strain that you're comfortable with, that you know where it's going to attenuate to, and so that you're comfortable with it and it's not going to like turn into a grenade when it comes time for packaging, which is my biggest thing when people start talking about bottle conditioning. This is kind of off the subject a little bit, but I want to say it, is that you always use a strain that the wort has already seen, that the beer has already seen. So like anytime I bottle condition, I use the Dre Brett, and the beer has already seen that. So I know that when I add sugar and that Brett kicks off, it's not going to go any further than I think. I hear a lot of brewers talk about using like a champagne yeast or something, and I mean, God, you don't have enough control over these beers to begin with. And then you're going to go use a yeast that you've never maybe used a couple times in your life. It's going to make some, it's going to go a little bit further. You don't know what you're doing when you do that. And so that's kind of my suggestion.
Interesting. Yeah. And so when you do that, how far down does your Saison get then when you bottle it? Like ours generally goes down to 1.5. Like at what point would you say it's safe to bottle before you don't have to worry about the Brett kicking up and causing bottle bombs?
So for me, we do probably like around a 9 Plato beer. It it leaves the primary fermenters at around 1.5 to 1.8. And then we bottle around 1.2 or 1.3. That's always batch dependent. And so that's why I use the same Brett strain that was in there during primary, because I'm comfortable that it's not going to go further. I'm going to add enough sugar to get the carbonation level I want, but it's not going to go any further than that. And so if you're doing a primary fermentation with only Saison yeast, if you're going to bottle condition it with Brett, it's going to be tough to do because you don't really know exactly where it's going to go. So you got to kind of do those experiments to see what's going on. The easiest suggestion, which is what I do, is to make it a mixed culture to begin with. And then I know over 6 weeks where that finishes, that's where it is. And it's easy to bottle after that because I'm not worried about going any further. But it's a sour beer. It's a wild beer. You've got to give it the time it needs to do its thing, and you've got to know what your yeast strains you're using and know your yeast. That's a big thing.
Thanks for the call, Alex. Good luck up there. Let us know how it goes.
Yeah, excellent advice, Troy. So, Troy, I know we're running a little long. You know, we call it the sour hour. In here, we call it the sour hour and a half because we're always running long. But thanks for being so generous with your time. I want to get you out on this question. And I love asking this one, so I'd love to hear your thoughts. What do you think the biggest mistake in sour beer making is?
So I'm a big fan of your show, and I was kind of expecting that question. And then when you guys started, you kind of talked about it already. I think the biggest mistake American brewers do is sour mash. And I was really excited to hear, is it Chris, right?
Yep.
Yeah, Chris, I was really excited to learn how you do yours because that sounds awesome. And so for me, like 9 times out of 10, when I try a sour mash beer, it's just not good. Your method sounds awesome. And so I'm really excited that you got to share that with everybody today. But there's too many brewers that are doing that see dollar signs when it comes to making sour beers. And so they figure out the fastest, easiest way to do it. And then just because it's sour, they sell it. It might have a lot of those flavors like you're talking about, the isovaleric, isobutyric, the poopy diaper. Oh, those are just awful. And so it really gives a bad rep for everybody. And so that's my biggest gripe is if you're going to do a sour mash beer, my favorite ones have been like where brewers will do a single batch, let it go for 24, 48 hours, hopefully in a similar method like you described, Chris. And then they'll boil that, rack it up into the fermenter, but it's a double brew. And so the next one they do is clean. And so that the acidity isn't the dominant character of the beer. It's just part of it, which is a great thing, because it's easy to make sour beer. It's easy to make bitter beer. It's easy to make sweet beer. It's easy to make salty beer. But when it comes down to it is, if can you make those done well, which is where sour mashing has a good opportunity to it. But only if it's done well, and if brewers need to be willing to dump the beer if it's turns out bad, because otherwise it's just bad for all of us. But I think there's too many brewers that just see dollar signs and they go after it.
Absolutely. And speaking of beers done well, Troy, these beers have been incredible tonight. Thank you so much for sending these out. And you know, I know often on the show we're making people jealous of the beers we're drinking. I wanted to mention, coming up on December 6th, you got a pretty humongous, awesome, you should book a plane ticket right now kind of bottle release. Can you tell us about some of the beers you're going to be releasing then?
So since we're only doing about 40 to 50% of our production right now, as we wait for that lambic style beer to come of age, we're only open once a month. So we're open the first Saturday of every month in Glenwood Springs. Our website is caseybrewing.com. Every month we're open that first Saturday. We've got something new for release. We'll sell as much as we can, then we self-distribute the rest. So we sell as much, whatever's left, we'll sell as much as we can here in our valley, which is from Glenwood Springs up to Aspen. Anything left over after that goes to the Front Range between Fort Collins and Denver. On December 6th, we're releasing 5 beers, 3 of them which are new. So we took the same cultures that were in that Saison that you guys are trying, and we made a new beer called East Bank, which is a kind of a stronger farmhouse ale. So it's a 12 Plato beer. We think gets around 6.5% alcohol, made with local fresh Glenwood Springs honey. That honey created a lot of flavors that I was not expecting at all. It's definitely different. We get some higher phenols, I think, because of the simple sugars that were in that honey. And there's definitely some like comb type notes to it. So I'm excited to see what people think about it. We also have a new version of our fruit stand, which is made with fresh grapes. So we got Cabernet Sauvignon grapes from Palisade. So that's kind of fun. Got a color and flavor that we've never seen before. And then we also did a collaboration with a brewery that I'm very close with here in the Valley, which is Roaring Fork Beer Company in Carbondale. We did a collaboration. We're calling it Brett Loves Citra. So we did about 100% Citra, 12 Plato beer. And then we both we split up the wort. Mine is with some house cultures of Brett that I actually got from Cantillon. We got some lactose, some Pedio in there as well. So it's a little bit tart. Definitely some funky Brett notes in there, but the hops are just unbelievable. I mean, I think we all know that Brett does some crazy things with dry hop beers. This beer is not dry hopped, but it tastes like it is. And so, in the future, we need to learn more about what Brett does with dry hopping, because this beer is the thesis of that. So yeah, thanks for letting me plug that. I'm so happy to be here today, and this was fun talking with you guys. I miss you out there in California. I'd kill for rain right now, not snow.
Yeah, it's been blanketing the country, but we'll take any kind of water form we can get out here.
Yeah, right. No kidding. But he's right though. I did not spend this morning chiseling rain off my windshield.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But I've seen just from the pictures on your Facebook page, and you guys should all follow Troy and Casey Brewing Blended on Facebook and Twitter, and look at the beautiful taste room. It's worth the trip out. Make sure you get out there December 6th. Troy, thanks so much for your knowledge, and most importantly, thanks for sending your beers.
Yeah, you're the man, Troy. Thank
you. These are awesome, man. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, we'll talk again soon, Troy. Thanks so much. All right, wow, that was great. Troy is the man. He's like one of the nicest guys I've ever met, and he gave one thing I just want to mention. He gave an incredible talk. This is at a Craft Brewers Conference, and I think it was Washington, D.C. He was up there with Chad Jacobson of Crooked Stave, and just great knowledge. If you guys can snag that MP3 somehow off the interwebs, it's worth it. There's some smart fellows over there in Colorado. So, you know what? I think we're going to take an unprecedented fourth.
No, this is just the third. We'll do an unprecedented fourth segment, though.
We're going to do an unprecedented fourth segment, and I think we're going to hang out with Chris a little bit more, maybe pop open some of his beers and talk him over, and then maybe we'll wrap up the rest of the questions, too. You're listening to The Sour Hour on the Brewing Network. Be right back.
Hey, my brewing brothers and sisters, this is Jamel Zainashev, and I love a bold, hoppy beer, one that spits resin in your face and makes you cry, uncle. There are a lot of great hoppy beers out there, but at Heretic, we want to make something as bold, dank, and resiny as possible. We use hops at every chance we get, including multiple dry hop additions. The result is Heretic Evil Cousin. This light golden, 8% Imperial IPA has an easy malt character that helps take the edge off the massive bittering, but it takes a back seat to the in-your-face hop character. We make sure this beer finishes dry so the hops can jump out and slam you in the taste buds. If you can't get enough hoppy goodness, Evil Cousin is your cup of tea. Cheers.
disagree with me.
Please give up. You already lost the fight. Oh, my.
We're back. It's the Sour Hour on the Brewery Network. I'm Jay Goodwin. We're at the Hop Grenade in downtown Concord, where if you ride your bike here on a certain day of the week, you get 20% off your first pint. Is that true?
That's right. Lazy Sunday.
Lazy Sunday. Wow. Yeah. That's an incredible deal.
I ride my bike here every day. You know that?
Wow. You must get a great discount.
I do. Upwards of 20%.
Five finger. All right, we're running late here on the Sour, 3 hours and a half. What's the Brewing Network's policy on overtime pay? Time and a half,
no,
double time?
Double time, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Double time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Bevo's happy about that.
Double time on the OT? Yeah, although the thing is, I just never approve overtime for her. It is double time, but she just never gets to work it.
Okay. All right. We got two beers in front of us. They're both from Green Bench Brewery in St. Petersburg, Florida. We got Chris Johnson. What's your official title there, Chris?
I'm a co-owner and head brewer.
That's a sexy title.
Yeah, it's mostly when you look at me like that. So,
well, thank God we're on. What's the live stream? Livestream.
Yeah, it's a weird one. Brewingnetwork.com/TV.
There you go. Yeah. Brewingnetwork.com/TV. You can see Chris's face,
He
is the co-owner, head brewer. Green Bench Brewery. Yeah. And what are these beers that are in front of us?
All right. So the first one we have is called Surrealist IPA. It's a sour IPA. So it's essentially that joining of two things that should never be together, hops and sour. So it's a kettle soured beer that post kettle sour we treat like an IPA. The concept is essentially grapefruit. I mean, I know you guys have a lot of citrus here. We have a lot back home as well. If you're eating a grapefruit, a fresh one, we actually had a grapefruit tree in my backyard when I was growing up. And if you eat it without sugar, it's tart, but it's also bitter, and that's kind of the concept of this beer. So it's 7% ABV, again kettle soured. Huge malt bill though to kind of combat sort of the acidity.
Can you go into I'm tasting some malt flavors in here that I was not expecting.
Yeah, it's got a caramel 40, a base of Turo. It's got some Munich 20, it's got some Carapils, and it also has a little bit of C10, but for the most part it's high amounts of Munich 20. Okay. That's probably the most, and then right under that is probably C40. I know the recipe off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure it's somewhere around like 8% Munich 20. Like, it's a good amount of Munich 20.
It's got a real malt richness to it. And I was almost like, this is like, it's not like overly sweet or anything, but it's almost got like this slight chocolate character to it.
Yeah.
And you call it a sour IPA, and I'll try to describe, the taste of it for people who are just listening. It's not sour. It's bright.
Right.
It's brightening the beer with a little acidity, you know? So it's really nice, but continue with the rest of your process.
It's only 3.6, 3.7 pH usually. This is, I think, the third batch we've done since we opened. So basically it's the same process. We louder to the kettle. Once we're there, we do this, you know, kettle sour process. Like I mentioned, once I get to the pH, boil it. I mean, it's a ton of hops early on. I think theoretical, it's almost like 125 BUs. When you're using hops and a lower pH than normal, I find that you almost have to overdo the bitterness unit in order to combat, just for perception, because you won't even taste the bitterness unit at 60 BUs if you do a 3.7 pH beer. So you have to almost like double it in order to get the same. Now, true, who knows? I haven't actually run it through any sort of systems to see if in a lab to see if it, what the true BUs are, but in my theoretical, it's pretty high. And then I dry hop it. The feature hop in this is actually Hopsteiner's 5256, which is an experimental variety that has this awesome, awesome grapefruit character, and that's what it's only dry hopped with. And it's pretty heavy dry hop. It's almost 2 pounds per. Actually, yeah, a little bit over 2 pounds per barrel.
Nice. Dry hop. Yeah, that really comes out too. It, really interesting beer. And, you know, I wouldn't, if you're at the tap room, I wouldn't let the sour IPA put you off. It's definitely, you know, a very approachable beer.
Meant to be balanced.
Yeah.
But I get like grapefruit rind a lot. Like if you're eating grapefruit and you get sort of those pits a little bit, it's like has that cool flavor.
Big time. Man,
I need to eat more grapefruit. do we have any more questions from either the chat or the email or the phone, Scott?
Yeah, we do. We got a bunch of email questions, but we do have another one from the chat. Let me just explain briefly the hierarchy. Callers get precedent and then chatters and then emailers. And I fully appreciate the fact that not everyone can listen live. And so forgive me, people that emailed and, well, I would ask live if I could, but I'm going to give a precedent to Cedar Valley Brewing Company, who's in the chat. He said, if I'm culturing a beer in a plastic pail, would I want to add oak chips or ass oak chips, as Bevo typed it to me, to try and get a barrel-aged characteristic? If so, light or dark toast, and when to add them? So should he add them, first of all?
Can you repeat it? He's culturing a beer?
Yeah, he said, culturing a beer in a plastic pail. Would I want to add oak chips to try and get a barrel-aged characteristic?
Well, let me just take a whole sidetrack there. I'm a little bit against the plastic pail if he's talking about sour beer. It's allowing too much oxygen in there, unless he's going for a big introduction over a very short period of time, which is a different deal. I mean, you've got a lot of ingress of the oxygen through the plastic, but you've also got just the poor seal of most pail lids, which is actually usually the main culprit. So that's first, but if we're going to talk about oak, I mean, chips are a great thing. They even make, like, powders now. So it's like, basically, how chunky do you want your wood to be, basically? This is the question you have to ask yourself. And then, they're all good options. French is going to be a little bit softer. American's a little more aggressive. Hungarian is kind of somewhere in between. You're not too worried about the oxygen ingress characteristics of the different woods. But, you know, just to touch on that real quick, Americans is tighter. It's going to let less oxygen in. French oak is a little bit looser. It's going to allow a little bit more oxygen in. Anything to add on that, Chris?
I actually have more experience, or rather better results, from using spirals. I think you get a lot more surface area out of them. We use them all the time at our brewery and at Cigar City when I worked there. Like the humidor, the white oak, those are all like oak spirals we did in stainless. And that's how we do, for example, our French oak oud brune. We do it in stainless, and then after post-fermentation, we'll add spirals to it. Sometimes we'll go into actual barrels, but if we're looking for, like, kind of quick barrel age sort of characteristics, spirals is the way I would suggest doing it. I also would second kind of what you said, Jay. I would probably put that in a glass carboy if we're going to do it in a small batch.
Let me ask this. Does it truly mimic a barrel-aged characteristic? Like, in other words, when you taste a beer, can you tell the difference between, oh, they added oak chips, and, oh, this was aged in an oak barrel?
Depends how much you use for how long. I mean, we age all of our beers in oak barrels, but it's kind of funny. I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent here, but we do a lot of beer aged in oak barrels with 100% Brettanomyces fermentation along with lactobacillus. Now, if we didn't tell you that and you had one of our beers, you'd be like, there's no Brett in this, and it was not aged in an oak barrel. And it's because we're using both of those, you can call them ingredients, to have less flavor impact and let the secondary ingredients shine through. So we're using neutral oak barrels. So, you know, having a brewery that has all oak aged beers, some of them you can't even tell. It just depends on the status of the wood, how long the contact time is, all that. Can you mimic it? I'd say, yeah, hell yeah. I mean, that's why you're putting the oak in there. But you got to be careful. You know, I'd start really low. You can always add more oak, but you can't put toothpaste back in the tube. So what do you think about that, Chris?
Yeah, I think it completely depends on what you're trying to get.
Bevo's saying, yeah, you can.
You've tried.
She's put toothpaste literally back in the tube.
Squeezed too much onto her toothbrush and too cheap. You got to put it right back in there. Yeah.
Oh, she has a whole... Wow, she does have a technique.
I've done the same thing, by the way. I've pulled toothpaste tubes out of the trash can that my girlfriend has thrown away like they're empty, and I go, oh, no, they are not.
Yeah.
And I will cut it open with a pair of scissors and scoop the toothpaste out of it.
That's because he doesn't approve Overtime.
Overtime, yeah. So I got to get rid of that expression now. I mean, you guys just killed that.
Bevo opened her mouth to talk and then just shook her head and said, forget it.
Continue to eat the cheese.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on. Sorry.
Yeah, it's fine. I think it depends on what kind of oak character you're getting and how long you use it. For example, French oak. French oak is hard because if you pull it too soon, it's going to be harsh and full of tannin and difficult to honestly drink and patent. It's not as palatable. If you give it enough time, you'll get that sort of vanillin, rounded character that is phenomenal. White oak is cool because every white oak beer I've ever had, well, using spirals, that is, in my experience, turns out extremely tropical. White oak gives you this in like coconut and pineapple and just this papaya, like this really cool tropical flavor. And I think it's phenomenal when paired with hops. I think if you do a hoppy beer with white oak, like that is one of the best. We do a beer, Central Oak IPA, and it's our Green Bench IPA aged on American white oak, and it has this awesome try. It enhances sort of the hop character. It's not, in my opinion, as nice if you add it to, like, let's say a darker beer. You sort of have combating flavors, and it's difficult to sort of find a balance.
It's really cool. There's a lot of really cool things going on in the state of Florida with craft beer. I mean, you guys have your whole what's the Berliner Weiss that you got?
Oh, the Florida Weiss.
Florida Weiss. Yeah, and then Florida, you got all beer. all your uses of different types of wood and oak with different styles of beer. Really cool stuff. If you guys are down in Florida, you gotta check this scene out because it's growing real fast and there's some cool stuff going on. We have another question?
Yeah, we're running way over, so let's just do one more and then we'll save the rest for future shows. Let's cool. do a hopefully a sort of simple one. This one is from Michael Cafaro. He said, what is the recommended way for a homebrewer to carbonate a sour beer once ready to bottle or keg? And what considerations do we need to make regarding equipment for both bottle conditioning and force carbing?
Simple, but complicated. Yeah, so, you know, I'd say your homebrewer, do what is going to cost you the least amount of money. Like if you want and you're doing carbonating in kegs and then you're bottling off your Blickman beer gun or your More Beer counter pressure filler, you know, maybe it's time for an upgrade. You want another one of those? Buy another one, and now you have a sour bottler and then your regular beer bottler. Let's say you take your oldest corny keg. That's going to be your sour beer corny keg. I mean, it's really everything on down the line you have to consider. But, you know, it's to each his own with bottle conditioning versus carbing the beer and then bottling it. To me, as a home brewer, if you're looking for ease, I the second I got corny kegs and a kegerator and I could just force carb beer, it was like the greatest day of all time. So, you know, I'd stick with that. And then down the line, when you're trying to do more, do some bottle conditioning or heck, do both at the same time, you know? I don't know. How do you do your guys' beer, Chris?
Well, the way that we do it, I mean, we do a blend of sort of force carb and then Asian bottles, usually because we know that there's usually live yeast in most of our sour beers, other than, like, for example, the Surrealist, the Berliner, the French Oak Good Bruin. Those are kettle soured and then just sacked. But anything we go in a barrel with and then we're going to bottle later, we know there's live yeast in. When I was a homebrewer and I started doing sour beers, it's really to your discretion at that point. It's like, what are you most comfortable with? Are you comfortable with running, you know, the bacteria and Brett through lines? I really wasn't. So anything that had that happen, that immediately was a sour equipment. So you'd have to then spend money on more equipment. I think that the cheapest way and the easiest way is to turn your bottling bucket into your sour bottling bucket. And now you run sour beers into it, and then that is your bottle condition. And now you're not really afraid of anything. If you're using kegs, then you're talking about all your lines, all your disconnects, all that kind of stuff. You're probably going to be afraid of using that on your IPA, your pale ale that you're going to send to NHC or whatever competition you're going to send it to, and it turns into whatever. So I'd say use your best discretion, but know that whatever you use, I would personally, as a home brewer, just go ahead and use that as sours from now on.
For sure. And I think that's some good advice, especially with bottle conditioning. You may be able to bypass using some of your other equipment.
Exactly.
And especially some of that equipment can be a little pricey. So I think right now we got another beer in front of us. Let's hear a little bit about this and then let's sign it off because we deserve to get drunk after all this traffic and the 2 hour sour hour.
Damn right.
You know, let's
Although
get after
the, you know, for the people that are gang listening to this, as many people do with podcasts,
gang listening?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
I don't support that term.
Yeah, I feel like I'm being taken advantage of.
Yeah. Now, if you're gang listening right now, please stop, sir or miss.
Let's see. How about they're listening to shows back to back to back. Better?
Binging is a way better word.
Well, but then that's the whole...
makes me feel comfortable.
Doesn't gang listening imply there's a group of delinquents listening?
She did hop in right when you said that, didn't she? That's the
only they're talking about gangs? I'm done with my cheese.
I'm going to cut a hole.
I am done with my cheese.
She stuffed all the toothpaste back in the tooth.
I think they call it gang taping, you know, when you get you record like a bunch of shows back to back. So I just gang listening. Okay, binge listening.
It's a good word.
Jeez. Anyway, they probably just heard us sign off the last show with we got to get out there and watch the Giants game. We got no Giants game to go watch because they won it all.
Yeah,
and
I'm sorry for all the Royals fans out there. Anyone associated with any other baseball team like the Tampa Rays, you know, maybe their brewery is two blocks away from that stadium, Tropicana Field.
I don't go there every. Game, it's no big
deal. Bebo's holding. Look at what what is that? Dodgers credit card.
Ouch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's invalid in this. Cut it out. In this state.
Yeah, so, she spends a lot on it and gets almost nothing for it.
Oh,
terrific.
Right. What's up with this last beer?
Yeah, what's going on with this, Chris?
All right, so this is the first beer in our Web City Cellar series. So our cellar room that we climate control is for wine and spirit related sour beers. This beer was brewed in January. It is a rye sour brown, so heavy rye, lots of chocolate flavors. The malt bill is fairly complex. We kettle soured it to 3.1 pH, and post-heat exchange, I filled up Cabernet Sauvignon barrels from Sonoma County that I had shipped in and went into the cellar room and pitched Brettanomyces coccinii. So they fermented 100% in the barrels, where they then aged in the cellar room for 9 months. So the concept here was I didn't really want Brett character. I wanted so I picked the Brett C as sort of this neutral Brett that wasn't going to make a ton of sort of funky flavors, and also 100% Brett, so it would make a lot of funky flavors. But my concept was that I wanted it to be very dry, so I wanted a Brettanomyces, so I knew I would dry the beer out almost completely. I would have a good pellicle on the top so that as it sits in the barrel, I could avoid things like acetic acid. What I wanted is for this beer to be an American wild beer, American sour beer, really, not really wild beer, American sour beer. So that's why I used Brett, and it's all about grain bill complexity, oak, and wine character. And that's what I wanted from this beer, and then tartness. So those were the elements that I wanted to showcase. That's why I used Brett C. And so, it's the first, it's called For the Mad Ones. It's out now. We released it in October. And the concept with the Web City Cellar Series that every 4 months we release a brand new spirit barrel aged or wine barrel aged sour beer and or wild beer from that cellar room. So this is our first one.
It's an awesome beer. I had it yesterday also, but today it's kicking off like this nice chocolate strawberry ice cream kind of thing. It's like so smooth, and you know I say that, but I don't want it to translate as oh it's too sweet. You have reminiscence of sweet flavors, but it is dry. It is drinkable.
The perception of sweetness more
Absolutely.
Than actual sweetness.
Yeah, it's a really good beer.
I've never had anything like it.
Yeah.
It's unique.
And this so all the souring, you know, it's coming pre like the end of your brew day,
yep.
basically. I mean, it takes several days, obviously, to do the kettle souring.
Well, it's nice because I can come in on a Friday. I can mash it and move in my kettle, and I don't boil it till Monday.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a weekend thing.
It's a half day. He checks out early.
It's literally half day. I'm like, oh, we don't have to worry too much. It's just a kettle sour.
Rays have a double header on Saturday?
Yeah,
I'm out of here.
Those are the kind of things you can do as the owner and master brewer.
That's right. Awesome. Well, awesome beers, Chris. If you know anyone's out there traveling to St. Petersburg, you got to check this place out. Going to a Rays game and enjoying their first and second place finishes without any World Series titles. You got to check this out.
Well, glad I showed up.
But yeah, I think it's about that time. We should probably be signing off. So thanks to Scott and Bevo. Thanks to Chris from Green Bench. Thanks to Troy from KC Brewing and Blending for sharing all the beers. We'll see you guys in about a month on the next episode of the Sour Hour. Scott,
yes, sir.
You got anything left to say?
Oh no, but I want to hear the membership program and Rare Barrel plugs. Whatever.
Therarebarrel.com is our website.
Yeah.
And if you ever see our beer, please buy it.
Yeah.
We're trying to make more beer, but I don't have much. So let's go get a pint.
Hell yeah.
For all of us here at the Hop Grenade in downtown Concord, I am Jake Goodwin. This has been the Sour Hour signing off. Thanks, and see you guys next time.
Network.